Why doesn't God do something about it? The world's in bad shape. There are terrible things happening. People are suffering. Why doesn't God do something about it? We've heard this statement made, and perhaps we've made it ourselves, or at least thought it. We need to be very careful about such a statement, because we could easily find ourselves standing in judgment of God and exonerating ourselves of our duty in the world. Let me make an argument for what I'm getting at. Look at the language of that first reading we had. The privileged are lying on beds of ivory and luxurious couches. They eat lambs that have been fed milk and calves that have been fed grain. That means these animals have been set aside as offerings to God, and yet the rich are eating them. They drink wine to excess and use oils to anoint their bodies, while the poor are ignored in their need and in their growing poverty. To these people, the prophet Amos says, "Woe to you, complacent people! You will go into exile." For them, it is too late. Their fate is sealed, and it's too late to change their lifestyle and God's punishment. Now look at the language used in the gospel. We have a rich man, purple garments, fine linen, dining sumptuously. These are words of excess. We have a poor man with sores, hungry for scraps, dogs licking him. Words of desperate need. The gospel, too, is a story of a person for whom it is too late to avoid God's punishment. And hopefully it's sobering to hear it. But since it's a story, it's also a very stern warning to 2,000 years of listeners that there is a limit to what God will put up with, especially when it involves the desperate and needy people who are being treated unjustly. In both of these settings, we have people who have chosen to be blind to the poverty around them in order that they themselves might continue to live luxuriously. There are at least two capital sins at play here: gluttony and sloth. Gluttony is an excessive appetite for pretty much anything, but it's usually food and drink. It could be almost anything, though. Sloth is the choice not to nurture the spirit. It's engaging in the body and the physical world while completely ignoring the spiritual side of who we are. Beware. Jesus is warning us, beware. Make sure you don't run out of time. I have done my part in your deliverance and salvation, but you must do your part or you will surely suffer the fate of the rich man. In this lifetime, it is our responsibility to keep an active and right relationship with God. And it is our duty to see to the needs of those around us who are desperately in need of survival basics. Jesus says to every generation, "Woe to you! How dare you live in luxury while others are in need of food, clean water, shelter, honest treatment, and rest?" The story of the rich man and Lazarus is a parable, yes. But the first reading is not. It's real. And it tells us that God can punish. God does punish. God will punish. God is a God of mercy, but let's not get the impression that everything depends on God, and those of us fortunate enough to have plenty have no real imperative to give of ourselves. We can say that there's only so much we can do, and the world is so big, and there's so much going on. I understand where that comes from. I get it. But the dangerous thing is that we can be so quick to exonerate ourselves from all responsibility and just lay back and say, "Oh, well, God will fix it and sort it all out." The first reading is proof that God can indeed be merciful all by himself. He can indeed handle justice all by himself. He can do that. And when God did just that very thing, the complacent Israelites lost everything they had. And they were taken away from their homes, and they were put into chains of slavery to pagan masters. So God can handle it all by himself. But we may not like the outcome. So again, woe to the complacent. Woe to anyone unconcerned about justice for the poor. Because the God who gives can take away as well. God is merciful. But to receive God's mercy, we must be in a frame of reference to ask for and accept his mercy. Our lives and our relationship with God and the poor he loves so well must reflect our awareness that all that is good comes from God. God loves us. And the best way to receive his mercy is to be merciful to others. For this to happen, we have to be aware of the needs of others, and aware of our own need for mercy because of sins such as sloth and gluttony. You know, if we were going to go to confession, we'd make an examination of conscience, wouldn't we? We can likewise check our justice quotient with a good examination as well. Half of the children who die today will die from the effects of dirty water. How much do I spend maintaining a pool, or watering my lawn, or washing my car? Many will suffer and die today from hunger. Do I consume more than my true need of the world's food supply? Could my food consumption habits change and that wealth be redirected toward the hungry? People are homeless. How many homes do I own? How many empty rooms are in my house? Could I downsize and serve others with the savings? Could I bring someone into my home to live? Little children serve as forced labor to produce the goods that we use. How blind am I to this awful truth? Could I examine my consumption of goods regarding this? What is my voting record on laws that serve my wants over the need of the common good? How much of my paycheck do I budget for charity? As I take a stance on pro-life, how much help do I offer young mothers who choose to save their babies' lives? Time is one of our most precious assets. How much time do I offer in service to God and others compared to that which I spend on sports or golf or television? What does my prayer life look like? Let me close with a word about disposition and time. Think again about the rich man suffering the fiery torments of hell. Even there, he sees Lazarus as one who was less than he. And he suggests that Lazarus be sent to serve his needs. And then again, to serve the needs of the rich man's brothers on earth. The rich man shows no remorse and still sees Lazarus as someone to be used. Our disposition toward God and others at the time of our death goes with us into eternity. There is no magic eraser between death's door and the throne of judgment. The time for change is now. not later. And as I mentioned, time, while our disposition is all ours and of all of our making, time belongs entirely to God. Now, we can convince ourselves that there is always plenty of time, but Jesus warns us in this parable and in others, the clock is ticking for each one of us. God is love. God is mercy. God has put our salvation in place, but we must ask for this mercy. We must take part in the event of our salvation. We are not bystanders. We are participants. And how we participate is reflected in our attention to God and to the poor.